Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. Okay, so we're back, folks. Welcome back. It's now or never. And don't forget that debt is all fraud. Maybe one of these days I'll actually take the time to actually go through how from the 16th Amendment to today, how we accumulated debt and how we've never paid it off. That was the design. The 16th Amendment did not give the federal government the ability to just run up this debt. And so it was a lot of different assumptions, but one of these days I'll just go through this so that we actually have the facts. We present the facts to you so that you understand that just know this. If they're spending money on something like transportation, medical care, housing, and regulating things like our environment, labor, all of those things are not enumerated. So every penny that the federal government is spending on providing some form of government regulations and basically manipulation and controlling us, every penny that's spent that is not enumerated, they don't have the authority to do that, it is fraud. And when we look at all of the money that they're spending, like the Build Back Better, transportation, all of these things, they have no authority to do this in the Constitution. This is why we have all of these petitions. But anyway, back to the content, and we actually have Tammy back. Welcome back, Tammy.
Hello. Welcome back. Thank you.
So hopefully this is working out. I won't be telling stories as much anymore. But at this point in time, we've got to wrap up what Jefferson was basically stating in his recollection of how they agreed to allow the Assumption Act to move forward. Now, Madison was absolutely spot on correct that this was unconstitutional. The federal government couldn't do this. It couldn't create advantages for one state over another state. These things were antithetical, but Jefferson thought it was an important thing. Now, technically, what should have happened is the southern states should have followed what Jefferson and Madison did later in 1798. In other words, the southern states should have actually stepped forward and said, you can't do this. You can't do this. So what actually ended up happening is they created a compromise that because Madison stopped, because that's where we kind of left off, and I'll read that kind of that last sentence, two sentences. And I'll tell you one thing. Jefferson writes, he's probably the king of run-on sentences. And as a homeschooler teaching your children to, you know, write good sentences, you may not want to show him Jefferson's. But anyway, so this was the last line that you read. They did so. It ended in Madison's acquiescence in a proposition that the question should be again brought before the House by the way of an amendment from the Senate, that though he would not vote for it nor entirely withdraw his opposition, yet he should not be strenuous but leave it to its fate. And then this is what Jefferson throws in where he thinks, you know, and he kind of says this in a way that doesn't make him look like, you know, this land speculator that he unfortunately did. But anyway, go ahead from that point.
I'm going to find this spot.
It was observed.
Okay. It was observed, I forget by which of them, that as the pill would be a bitter one to the southern states, something should be done to soothe them. That the removal of the seat of the government to the Potomac was just a measure.
And the Potomac. That was the Potomac. That's how they spelled Potomac.
Potomac. Uh-huh. Oh, okay. To the government, to the Potomac was just a measure, would probably be a popular one with them, and would be a proper one to follow the assumption. It was agreed to speak to Mr. White and Mr. Lee, whose districts lay on the Potomac, and to refer to them to consider how far the interests of their particular districts might be sufficient inducement to them to yield to the assumption. This was done. Lee came into it without hesitation. Mr. White had some qualms, but finally agreed. The measure came down by way of amendment from the Senate and was finally carried by the change of White's and Lee's votes. But the removal to... How do you say that again?
Potomac.
Potomac.
Uh-huh.
But the removal to Potomac could not be carried unless Pennsylvania could be engaged in it. This Hamilton took on himself and chiefly, as I understood, through the agency of Robert Morris, obtained the vote of that state on agreeing to an intermediate residence of Philadelphia.
Right.
This is the real history of the assumption, about which many erroneous conjectures have been published. It was unjust, in itself oppressive to the states, and was acquiesced in merely from a fear of disunion.
Right,
because while the government was still in its most infant state.
Uh huh. Right. So as he said before, forgive me for cutting you off, but as he said before, that Hamilton and the way the northern states, you know, they couldn't see fit, because he basically said they were threatening to leave the Union. And as a matter of fact, we actually went through this in the ratification debates of Massachusetts, where Massachusetts said, why do we need the Union? You know, we can live without the Union. We clearly can fight for ourselves, and we can protect ourselves. We don't need, so Massachusetts barely crossed the finish line. It was because of John Hancock and actually Samuel Adams stepping onto, because Samuel Adams was against the Constitution and this permanency of the Union, but he actually stepped over after John Hancock suggested making some suggested amendments with ratification. And Samuel Adams said, well, that's brilliant. You know, and was very laudatory towards Hancock. But anyway, the point is this, is that there was this fear of disunion, and this was buying those states into the Union. In other words, Hamilton was getting to the foundation of corruption. We'll buy your souls with money. And they did the same thing with the southern states. And the way they got Pennsylvania, because figuring out, one of the things that they had to do is they had to figure out where the seat of government was going to be. They had to create this, you know, this little landmass where Washington, D.C. would be. Mm-hmm. And so that was proffered by Hamilton. He says, I can put it in the South for you, right here in Virginia and Maryland. And so... You know, and Jefferson, okay. And as I understand it, he looked to do some land speculation. Whether he purchased land or not is another story, but I believe in, I think it was Dumas Malone's, where he was accused of doing land speculations, not only then, but even later in the XYZ affair. But anyway, go ahead and finish the last line here.
Okay. It enabled Hamilton so to strengthen himself by corrupt services to many that he could afterwards carry his bank scheme and every measure he proposed in defiance of all opposition. In fact, it was a principal ground whereon was reared up that speculating phalanx in out of Congress, which has since been able to give laws and to change the political complexion of the government of the U.S.
Okay, so the phalanx. So phalanx. Speculating phalanx in and out of Congress, which has since been able to give. So he basically, you know, kind of shows how this political compromise, even though it was unconstitutional. I mean, he even admits that, you know, this was something that happened, but they felt it's better to save the Union. This, you know, whether we like it or not, politics is compromise. And when we have, when our politicians compromise on something they don't have the power to compromise, we always lose. This is why when I tell folks, you know, the law, the supreme law of the land only allows Congress, the federal government, to compromise over very specific things. Do we go to war or not go to war? That's what they have the legitimate compromise to face. Whether we spend money on education, you know, all this money on education or all this money on health care, that's not for them to compromise. They can't just say, you know, well, if I do, if I spend money on education, you could spend money on, you know, defense spending. No, you can't do that. But that's how they've been doing it, because when the parties took over Washington, D.C., when the parties took over this nation in the 1850s, the party basically started convincing people, well, as long as we agree, it's okay. As long as we compromise and come to an agreeable, you know, situation, then it's okay. And they did it gradually, right? They didn't just come in and say, you know, we're going to take control of your children, right? When did the Department of Health wasn't created until the 1950s, 1952, when the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare came along. So it, they took their time slowly growing and growing. You know, Satan knew that we would reject this huge leap into communism. Right. But he knew gradually we would be swimming in the waters and doing all sorts of tricks, calisthenics and so forth. I, you know, I forget, the, what is that that swimming competition where they just dance and all of that? What, coordinated swimming, whatever. Anyway. So that's where we are today. I mean, we would never have been in this pool of water had it not been this gradual succession of getting us into it. So anyway, the next document that we're going to cover, folks, and so these documents will be put up on the podcast page so that, you know, you'll actually be able to go through these. And actually, I'm going to start, I'm going to create, the next page I'm going to create for Reclaiming the Republic will be all the resources, because I put these up and then they get, they go away when I move everything over to the archives. Because if you go to the archives, you can't see all of the documents. So we're going to have a resource page where you can actually download these things so that if you find something in the archives, you go, yeah, they're reading something. Because we don't get the chance to do everything. And we want you to have the history of all of this. And if you have the documents, it helps as well. So the next document is actually called the Funding Act of 1790, which is this particular act. And what we're interested in is not the top part of the page. It starts halfway down. And I've highlighted it in yellow where it says August 4th, 1790. And so if you let me know when you get it up, I will kind of shut up. But what we're going to do, because I'm going to give you a precursor, we're not going to read this whole thing. We're talking about, you know, probably six plus pages. And what we want to do is I kind of just want to highlight the one point where they actually talk about the money that they're basically throwing out into these dollars. So that this state will get this much, this state will get this much, and this state will get this much, and so forth. And actually, that is on page 5 of the 7 pages. It starts with page 142, and it's section 11 of the Funding Act. Are you there? Now, these are basically commissioners of how the money is going to be distributed. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. And so these are commissioners. So what they ended up doing is they're going to assume these debts, and then they have these commissioners that are going to get paid to selling bonds. And so this is how they kind of break down, you know, how that is to be paid. And it's kind of, I'll just say kind of nefarious. But if we go down a little bit further, And you'll see not, if you actually go scroll down towards the bottom of the page, you'll see provided that no greater sum shall be received in the certificates of any state than as follows, that is to say. And you see that part?
Yep.
Okay, so in those of New Hampshire, $300,000. In other words, this is kind of the amount of the debt that they're assuming. $4 million on Massachusetts part.
Wow.
$200,000 on Rhode Island. $1 million on Connecticut. $1 million, and you got to remember, Massachusetts was a pretty big state.
$1,600,000.
Yes, 106. Yeah, that was Connecticut. New York, $1,200,000. New Jersey, $800,000. See, New Jersey was a pretty good sized state. Actually, it didn't have a lot of people, but New Jersey, you know, you could see how the prices kind of go down a little bit. But what they did was they tried to soften the blow by giving this equal debt per capita. In other words, it wasn't just going to be giving these favors because these other states didn't need the favors. When we get into the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 8, there's this thing called the preamble to the Constitution. And so when we actually call up, you know, Article 1, Section 8, and I'll pull up the color-coded Constitution real quick. And Article 1, Section 8, the preamble lays out this, what we call the uniformity clause, that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare of the United States. But all duties, imposts, and excises shall be uniform throughout the United States. So the way this had to pass, even though the benefit was truly going to Massachusetts, there was an equal benefit that went to the rest of the states. They didn't need it, but they got an equal benefit. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So as you look, how much money did Virginia get?
Virginia,
$3,500,000. $3,500,000, where Massachusetts got $4 million. And as a matter of fact, the one thing that most people don't know, because how was this being done? And in some ways, this was being done based on the population and the census, because you got to remember, they hadn't conducted the census yet. And so the first census under the United States, once it was conducted in 1790, they were in the process of doing this. Come to find out, Massachusetts was smaller in population than Virginia. Virginia was the biggest dog of all. They had the largest population because Kentucky was still a part of them. Once Kentucky broke away, then Virginia's, you know, population went down. Same thing with North Carolina. North Carolina was like fourth or fifth in population. When Tennessee broke away, their population went down again. And so, anyway, I was going to pull up, you know, the state control and the joining of the, you know, populations, all of that, but I, you know, no point in diving into those weeds. The whole point that we wanted to really cover was, you know, how much money was actually going out and how they actually were buying off everybody. In other words, Hamilton was basically getting everybody corrupted, a little bit drunk off of the public purse, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, South Carolina, look at that, $4 million to South Carolina. $4 million. So $4 million, because South Carolina was one of those states that actually, you know, couldn't pay their debt. They didn't pay their debt because they were so small. In other words, right, population-wise. And so maybe what I'll do during the break is I will go find the statehood order. That's the file I have that will actually, you know, help us take a look. And actually I found it, and when I look at the original order, I actually have the population of the states. And so South Carolina, this is again based on the 1790 they didn't have yet, but let me see here. South Carolina was 249,000. Virginia was 691,000, and Massachusetts was 387. So Massachusetts was half the size. So if the state being the most populated, being Virginia, almost 700,000 people, based on population, they should have got more. But they didn't, because the census was awry. They, you know, they didn't really have a formal census. The Constitution required that they do a census. And they didn't, they initiated the census at the same time. So these were all guesses. And then based on that initial census, they would be reapportioned for representation in the House of Representatives as well. So the next time they had the election in 1790, they still didn't have the, because it took time in those days to do that stuff. And so they did, I don't believe they had the census until, and they made the adjustment in 1792, where Virginia actually increased with its representation. And then when Kentucky broke off, they took a, you know, their representation with them. But anyway, so it kind of helped show that maybe they were doing their best, you know, in trying to do things, because I don't think that, you know, Hamilton would take advantage if he could, but I don't think that this was one of those things that he could have taken advantage, because they wanted to make sure, you know, nuts and bolts, everything was, you know, lined up on the information that everybody was going on. So the next document that we're going to get into that is going to take a little bit of time is the debate over the national debt. Now, this is kind of a longer document, so we may not be able to get through this today. But it is worth starting now, because what we want to do is we want to cover the actual debates. And it's going to start off, I believe, with Madison. So let me kind of read the precursor, and then we'll hit, when we get down to the speeches in the House, I'll let you read what Madison said, and then I'll let you read what Ames Fisher said, then what Thomas Jefferson said, and then what the creature said. Okay, so this is an excerpt out of the documentation history of the first federal Congress of the United States. So in other words, this is out of the congressional record from March 4th, 1789, to March 3rd, 1791, and out of the digital edition. And it gives all the credits to whom and the University of Virginia and all of that. As a part of his ambitious economic plan, he's talking about Hamilton, for revitalizing the nation's finances in the wake of the War for Independence, the Secretary of the Treasury, Alexander Hamilton, proposed that Congress charter a national bank. This proposal soon provoked one of the bitterest political and constitutional debates of the 1790s, fracturing the United States along ideological and regional lines. Now, setting the stage here, because you notice that Madison's speech that kind of covers February 2nd, 1791. Now, before you read, I want to kind of set the stage a little bit better than just that. Now, the Assumption Act was thrown out there because why? Hamilton needed to have a reason to tax the states. They already had this debt that they needed to collect, and they already knew what the states needed to pay. Had they followed the design, all they would have done was they basically would have been taxing the states proportionally on top of the cost of the general government functioning. So we're going to be going into break real quick here. So I'll pause there. And so when we come back, we will actually dive into, you know, this, but I'll finish this little precursor of why what Hamilton did with the Assumption Act set the stage, opened the door for him to do this, and Jefferson and Madison were none the wiser. They were absolutely caught off guard. They were on their heels, and they were upset. They were really pissed. Anyway, we'll be right back after this short promo. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so I can't imagine anybody listening that has never had a real maniacal person get injected into their life. And it never happens immediate to where when that you see that person, you have the full understanding of the wrath that is going to come down upon you because your relationship with this person, right? I mean, it takes a long time. And if the person is really maniacal, like Hamilton, you have no idea. It takes a while before you actually start seeing all of the cards that he's going to play. You know what I'm talking about, Tammy?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody does.
Yeah. So it doesn't really happen until you finally have the epiphany that you've been played, that this person has been taking advantage of you, and you never saw this, because sometimes we just give people the benefit. Now, historically, at this point in time, in 1790 with the Assumption Act, and this was a common, I mean, these Hamilton and Madison had been working together to move this Constitution, to get this government going on the right direction. And folks, I'm going to tell you this. This is the most important thing you need to know right now. Everything that was stipulated in the ratification debates, we have a solid document that did not have any back doors to it. Hamilton had to use these assumptions or these terms of the implication of power, implied power. He had to get people to start redefining this Constitution. We're actually, Tammy, you're going to read here where, and when we hit the red font, we'll pause on that and really dive into this, but you're going to read here where Madison actually cites the ratification debates as the foundation of how this Constitution must be, you know, understood by, how those terms and definitions in the ratification debates are legally binding. And, I mean, he's unbeatable on this. But Hamilton has to convince these other Federalists in office to say, well, yeah, but this implication is something we can reach to and we can go ahead and get away with because they already did. In other words, when he got them to use the implication of taking and assuming debt, they already poisoned themselves because they did something they shouldn't have done that was not enumerated, if that makes sense. And so Hamilton was playing everybody. He was a key figure, and he was the most key figure that put us on this path of destruction. Now, I've said this before. I don't believe he understood the magnitude like Judas understood what he did. I don't believe he had Hamilton lived long enough to see his life move forward, because it took so long to unravel with what he was doing. I only think that it was a godsend that the good Lord took him from us with the duel with Aaron Burr, that he suffered that death of indignity, you know, with his wife by his side, who actually had to suffer from his adulterous affair, all these things that this man did. I mean, I'm not perfect, and I'm not judging him. All I'm saying is that I believe that the nation was saved, or I should say the assault on the Constitution or our liberty was kind of muted a little bit. Not that it wasn't happening, because Marshall was doing what he was doing. But I think had Hamilton stayed alive, he would have been able to work with other people and get other things in motion to cause the calamities to happen even sooner. That all being said, and actually, let me go back to this too. Those midnight judges that Hamilton had Adams pick, go through the lifespan of those judges. Those judges created a trend in the judiciary of pro-slavery, where we actually had judges that were okay with, you know, the Missouri Compromise and those types of things, which were actually other unconstitutional things. So Hamilton really did some damage. I mean, some serious damage. And this is why this is so important. This right here was the true, because in 1791 was the beginning of the march that Hamilton had on destroying by creating this unconstitutional bank. Having gone through the ratification debates, the word bank, B-A-N-K, regarding a financial institution was mentioned twice in all of the debates, if I remember correctly. That's how profoundly unmentionable it was. It wasn't even fathomed that the nation would have a bank. But what Hamilton did by assuming this debt, he used that as a justification to kickstart an aggressive taxation program and then kickstart this necessity of saying, if we have a bank, then we can actually start making money by selling bonds. Well, there's nothing in the Constitution giving the federal government the ability to make money as a banking institution. And so when they took this over, when they created this national bank, they actually started controlling the banking system, which was integral and critical for the globalist foothold and control of all governments. So anyway, I'm going to let you go now and start reading the Madison's, these are Madison's comments in 1791 on the floor in Congress. Go ahead.
So Mr. Madison began, "Is the power of establishing an incorporated bank among the powers vested by the Constitution and the legislature of the United States? This is the question to be examined." After some general remarks on the limitations of all political power, he took notice of the peculiar manner in which the federal government is limited. It is not a general grant out of which particular powers are accepted. It is a grant of particular powers only, leaving the general mass in other hands. So it had been understood by its friends and its foes, and so it was to be interpreted.
Okay, so right there, what he basically said was that the federal government does not have general powers. They just don't have the discretion to do whatever they want. It is, as he says, not a general grant. It is particular powers that are accepted. And so only these powers do they have the ability to do, leaving the mass in the state's hands. The 12th Amendment clarified all of that. And as a matter of fact, I believe the 12th Amendment had not, because it wasn't until 1791 December when the Bill of Rights were ratified, because that's when the Bill of Rights basically, powers not delegated are reserved. So it hadn't been ratified yet. So that was still out there. And so go ahead. Next paragraph.
As preliminaries to a right interpretation, he laid down the following rules. An interpretation that destroys the very characteristic of the government cannot be just. Where a meaning is clear, the consequences, whatever they may be, are to be admitted. Where doubtful is fairly triable by consequences. In controverted cases, the meaning of the parties to the instrument, if to be collected by reasonable evidence, is a proper guide. Contemporary and concurrent expositions are a reasonable evidence of the meaning of the parties.
Okay.
Let me keep going.
Yeah, keep going. Yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah. That all stands out. Right.
Okay. In admitting or rejecting a constructive authority, not only the degree of its incidentality to an express authority is to be regarded, but the degree of its importance also, since on this will depend the probability or improbability of its being left to construction.
Okay, so in left to the design, right? So what he's basically laying out in these two paragraphs is, you know, moving forward, these are the rules we kind of have to abide by, that, you know, we can't be necessarily creating interpretation, that because an interpretation, as he said before, destroys the very character of the government, which cannot be just. So where a meaning is clear, the consequences, whatever they may be, are admitted. Where doubtful, it is fairly triable by consequences. In convertible case, the meaning of to the parties to the instrument, if to be collected by reasonable evidence, is a proper guide. So in other words, what did he just say there? In controvertible cases, the meaning of the parties to the instrument. In other words, how the parties understood the instrument being the Constitution. When he uses the word instrument here, he's talking about the Constitution. When he talks about construction, he's talking about the design of that. And so he basically is laying out this, you know, this is how we have to look at this, not how we think, not how we interpret, but how the states understood it. If it is something that absolutely requires interpretation, he's saying that it becomes destructive to the character. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he's laying this out. This is before, I don't even think he knew where Hamilton was getting his playbook out of the Federalist Papers with interpretation. But Hamilton did know in the way Hamilton tried to argue the Assumption Act that there was this implication and interpreting this. So he laid down a gauntlet that made it impossible for it to be construed as, you know, okay for them to create a bank. He already said that, you know, that the precursor to this, where I said that they only had these powers. And then he kind of talks about, you know, how the parties understood this, that that's what they had to rely upon. So anyway, go ahead. Reviewing the Constitution. Go ahead from that point.
Reviewing the Constitution with an eye to these positions, it was not possible to discover in it the power to incorporate a bank. The only clauses under which such a power could be pretended are either the power to lay and collect taxes to pay the debts and provide for the common defense and general welfare, or the power to borrow money on the credit of the United States, or the power to pass all laws necessary and proper to carry into execution those powers.
Those foregoing powers, right. Okay, so yeah. So right there. He lays out, moving forward, he says, then, you know, if it's going to be construed, we'd have to find it in one of these three clauses. So he lays these things out, and he's basically, because he's already pointed out that it is not specified there. And so it is this necessary and proper clause that actually Hamilton uses, because this is where Hamilton starts playing with this. But let me go back to the very specific clause, because you got to remember that this is kind of an excerpt, right? And so when I go to the color-coded Constitution, folks, I love that. Not because I did it, but I think this is how we can start learning what each clause in the Constitution is. The necessary and proper clause is found at the very end of Article 1, Section 8. It's the very last line. It says, to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers, in other words, these powers that we just listed to you, and all other powers vested in this Constitution. In other words, if it's something that is a derivative of these powers we just listed, or something else within the Constitution that has been vested to the general government, then those laws shall be necessary and proper. Period. So Madison is basically creating the case, and he's creating a very succinct argument that it doesn't exist. There is no there regarding a bank. So go ahead and keep reading, because you're going to see we've got some red font coming up.
Okay, so do you want me to read that little one under three or no?
Yeah, so actually that was a part of that. The third case is which gives the power to pass all laws necessary and proper to execute the specified powers. I mean, that was just rephrasing what I just said. So go ahead with whatever meaning.
Okay, so whatever meaning this clause may have, none can be admitted that would give an unlimited discretion to Congress. Its meaning must, according to the natural and obvious force of the terms and the context, be limited to means necessary to the end and incident to the nature of the specified powers. The clause is, in fact, merely declaratory of what would have resulted by unavoidable implication as the appropriate and, as it were, technical means of executing those powers. In this sense, it had been explained by the friends of the Constitution and ratified by the state conventions.
So already he's pointing to how the Constitution was justified in the ratification debates. He actually he revisits this down a little further, but here, let me dive into this now. Okay, so he basically lays out that these terms and the nature of the specified powers were very clear. And he actually says the clause is, in fact, merely a declaratory clause that those things that are unavoidable by implication. So I'll give you an implication, something that's not within the powers, but within Article 2, where the president it is within the powers, because it's a uniform rule of naturalization. In other words, the federal government has the responsibility of accounting for and protecting U.S. citizens. So what happens when citizens travel abroad? Well, the federal government has that responsibility in interfacing people coming in and leaving the United States. So if you happen to be a U.S. citizen, it would be implied that they would have a way of verifying if you left and you came back, because out of millions of people, it would be unreasonable to have to have only one person that would have all knowing and capability of memorizing everybody, to have a mechanism of identification so that when you left and you came back as a U.S. citizen, you would have some form of identification to make your re-entry into the United States easy, so that they created a passport system. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So for their ability, they do not have the ability to make national identification. Do you need a passport to survive? No. The passport only comes into play when you choose to leave, travel abroad, and then you come back. You need the passport then. So people that lived their entire lives in the United States and never had to travel abroad never needed a passport. And actually, the passport requirement didn't come back until, you know, our commerce really started opening up. So it was several decades later to where they said, you know, we need to have something because we, you know, there's too many dangers of letting the wrong people in. And so when they started realizing they had to have these safeguards, it was within reason and implication of those express powers. So moving on, the issue here is, was this reasonable for them to say that they needed a bank to lay, do they need a bank to have the laying of taxes and to pay the debts for the Commonwealth? No, they didn't need a bank. The power to borrow money on the credit? No, they didn't need a bank. What is a bank? What the function of a bank isn't just housing money, because the Treasury can house money. The bank is offering products and making money. A bank is basically a business that basically makes their money out of loaning and borrowing and those types of things. So in other words, Hamilton created a financial institution that would make money for the federal government by playing interest games and so forth. And down the road, you know, they weren't supposed to have paper money either. So, but the way they started, like we covered in the Assumption Act, he wanted to go down this path of selling bonds. Well, okay, we're selling these bonds, but we need a bank to really do this properly. That's why he created the argument for the bank by doing this. So anyway, go ahead.
The essential characteristic of the government as composed of limited and enumerated powers would be destroyed if instead of direct and incidental means, any means could be used, which in the language of the preamble to the bill might be conceived to be conducive to the successful conducting of the finances, or might be conceived to tend to give facility to the obtaining of loans.
Okay, stop right there. So actually, did you notice that he said the preamble to the bill? And then he cites this, right? So in other words, might be conceived to be conducive to the successful conducing of the finances, or might be conceived to tend to give facility to the obtaining of loans. In other words, creating bank products. That those aren't within the Constitution. Go ahead. Now, it says he urged, and at that point, that's Madison. There's basically, at that point, this is where Madison was kind of urging, and so when we see this, you can tell that this is kind of being written by the hand of somebody that instead of just gave you the words, they kind of show you the emotion. So he urged an attention to the diffuse and ductile terms. So are you back with this?
Yep.
Okay, so she's back. So go ahead and pick up where he urged and read on. Go ahead.
He urged an attention to the diffuse and ductile terms which had been found requisite to cover the stretch of power contained in the bill. He compared them to the terms necessary and proper used in the Constitution and asked whether it was possible to view the two descriptions as synonymous or the one as a fair and safe commentary.
Go ahead.
The latitude of interpretation required by the bill is condemned by the rule furnished by the Constitution itself.
Go ahead.
It is not pretended that every insertion or omission in the Constitution is the effect of systematic attention. This is not the character of any human work, particularly the work of a body of men. The examples cited, with others that might be added, sufficiently
inculcate,
nevertheless, a rule of interpretation very different from that on which the bill rests. They condemn the exercise of any power, particularly a great and important power, which is not evidently and necessarily involved in an express power.
Okay, keep on going.
It cannot be denied that the power proposed to be exercised is an important power. As a charter of incorporation, the bill creates an artificial person previously not existing in law. Let me go down just
right
a little bit. It confers important civil rights and attributes which could not otherwise be claimed. It is, though not precisely similar, at least equivalent to the naturalization of an alien by which certain new civil characters are acquired by him. Would Congress have had the power to naturalize if it had not been expressly given?
Okay, so one of the things he's actually laying out here is by creating this entity called the bank, incorporation, right? A character of incorporation, the bill creates an artificial person. And then he basically says, previously not existing in law, it confers important civil rights and attributes which could not otherwise be claimed. In other words, the federal government has no authority to create this entity. There's nowhere in there where they had this authority. Go ahead. Go back to the next paragraph.
Okay. He proceeded next to the contemporary expositions given to the Constitution. The defense against the charge founded on the want of a Bill of Rights presupposed, he said, that the powers not given were retained and that those given were not to be extended by remote implications. On any other supposition, the power of Congress to abridge the freedom of the press or the rights of conscience could not have been disproved.
Right. Okay, so now we're hitting the next red text. And so let's go ahead and we'll read just the red text.
The explanation in the state conventions all turned on the same fundamental principle, and on the principle that the terms necessary and proper gave no additional powers to those enumerated. Here he read sundry passage from the debates of the Pennsylvania, Virginia, North Carolina conventions, shewing the grounds on which the Constitution had been vindicated by its principal advocates against the dangerous latitude of its powers charged on it by its opponents.
Okay, so what did he do to prove that power regarding the definition of the necessary and proper clause, what did he use to actually say, hey, this is how it was justified, this is how it was defined? He used the ratification debates. So we're going to stop right here, and we'll pick it up tomorrow on the, you know, where we left off. But this is what's really important, and I think I'll try to squeeze this in. What never happened was they never went through the ratification debates and actually isolated each of the clauses by the Federalists of how each of these clauses were defined. In other words, had they gone through the ratification debates and said, here's every Federalist definition of the necessary and proper clause. Boom. Now we have five pages that help clarify how the Federalist actually defined that. Is there anything in these definitions that would be contradictory? No. Then we now have a very concise and thorough defining of that clause so that it can never be misconstrued or somebody could go down the path of interpreting. And in so doing, we definitize exactly what every line in that Constitution means based on the ratification debates. You cannot do that with the Federalist Papers, as I kind of lectured yesterday. So again, when we come back, folks, we'll be diving back into this. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.